today on Against the Grain. Supporting members of the military to resist deployment has taken on a new urgency as Trump sends troops into American cities. Journalist Steve Early discusses the history of soldier organizing, including as workers, from Vietnam to the present. And Suzanne Gordon discusses why the broad public should care about the attack on the 1,400 hospitals and clinics that serve veterans, the largest socialized medical system in the country. From the studios of KPFA in Berkeley, California, this is Against the Grain on Pacifica Radio. I'm Sasha Lilly. Since returning to office, Trump has sent the National Guard into Democratic-led cities, to Los Angeles, Memphis, and Washington, D.C., and his administration is waging court battles to try to send them to Portland and Chicago. He said recently he's ready to deploy National Guard members and even the active duty military, if necessary, to more U.S. cities to, quote, make them safe. Writer Suzanne Gordon is co-founder of the Bay Area-based Veterans Healthcare Policy Institute. She's co-author, with Jasper Cravens and Steve Early, of Our Veterans, Winners, Losers, Friends and Enemies on the New Terrain of Veterans Affairs. Steve Early is a labor journalist and lawyer. Steve, what do you think's at stake with the deployment of the military domestically? Why do you think we should be so concerned about this?
Well, it's obviously making a bad situation in this country with militarized policing far worse. It was only 5 years ago in the summer of 2020 that millions of people around the country, in response to the killing of George Floyd by a policeman in Minneapolis, staged huge protests, demonstrations, rallies, all kinds of activity aimed at demilitarizing policing, reducing the number of civilians killed by police every year, reforming police departments, shifting more resources into other approaches to public safety rather than having armed, uniformed officers on the street. Well, look where we are 5 years later. We haven't seen much police reform, unfortunately. And now we have an additional layer of militarized policing in the form of the military. In some cases, the active duty military that's been called up by Trump in Los Angeles, for example, but more commonly now, the widespread misuse of the National Guard being sent into states and cities around the country in response to non-existent increases in local crime.
The Posse Comitatus Act limits the military from being used for domestic law enforcement. However, the centuries-old Insurrection Act gives the U.S. government emergency powers under conditions of so-called rebellion or insurrection to use the active duty military for policing. Some listeners may remember when California Governor Pete Wilson used the Insurrection Act in the aftermath of the Rodney King upheaval in Los Angeles, but generally it has been pretty infrequently used. Trump has threatened to pull out the Insurrection Act to justify various deployments. It's obviously a lot of this stuff is tangled up in the courts, but in some ways these legal entanglements could be more easily sidestepped by just declaring an emergency and using the Insurrection Act. Given that, and given what you've just also said about the stakes, you have done a lot of organizing in the labor movement and amongst veterans and people in the military. Do you feel like at this moment people on the left should be spending additional energies right now in trying to organize and help people in the National Guard, for example, organize themselves?
Very definitely. And the progressive veterans groups that have been on the front lines of these kinds of efforts for years, Veterans for Peace, Common Defense, About Face, are all getting a tremendous response to the informational webinars and the organizational meetings and the legal support networks that they're setting up to inform both active duty military personnel, but particularly the citizen soldiers in the National Guard about their rights to the extent that they have them, informing them of ways that they can deal with situations that they may be plunged into on a more widespread scale. And I think that's a kind of a critical intervention. And it's coming, you know, from younger veterans who served in the military during the last 25 years, many of them combat veterans of our ill-fated occupations of Iraq and Afghanistan. And what they're seeing and what they're saying is that the, you know, the methods of occupation that were employed by the military when they were on active duty in the Middle East are now being utilized here at home. And, you know, 5 years ago, Trump was itching to go further than he was able to do. He was restrained somewhat in the summer of 2020 by his then defense secretary, by top generals, by others who kind of limited his use of both the National Guard and certainly the active duty military for domestic policing purposes. But it's hard to make any prediction about what Trump is going to do day to day. But I think it's safe to assume that, you know, he is going to plunge ahead in ways that are going to require a much higher level of resistance in different forms.
When Trump sent the National Guard and the Marines into Los Angeles, there were reports that there seemed like widespread dissatisfaction by members of the National Guard for being used by Trump in such a way. Do we have any sense of the attitudes of National Guard members on the one hand, active duty military on the other, about being deployed or the possibility of being deployed to occupy American cities?
Well, I mean, I think there was definitely some news reporting at the time of the LA deployments of the fact that, you know, when 40% of the Guard members involved are, you know, Latinos or from other immigrant backgrounds, there was not a lot of rank and file enthusiasm for being part of a roundup of undocumented immigrants. I think, interestingly enough, in the case of the Guard, the most publicly outspoken people about the politicization of the Guard have been retired National Guard generals. A whole group of them gave an interview to the New York Times in late September expressing a wide range of concerns and really objecting to the Guard being used for domestic policing purposes in a situation where, you know, there wasn't real civil disturbances until other federal agencies, particularly ICE, created the basis for militant demonstrations, which in just about every city where they've occurred, the local police departments, for better or worse, heavily staffed as they are, assured the press that they were, you know, capable of dealing with the situation without the Trump administration's call up. I think a lot of people sign up for the Guard because they want to serve their communities. You know, they want to be the heroes of Hurricane Katrina disaster relief. They don't mind being called out to help people in floods and fires. The Guard played a very important role in many states during the pandemic, setting up field hospitals and distributing medical supplies. I mean, Guard duty activity has already gotten a little stickier when you've been called out, you know, to police a strike or a student protest historically. But I think one impact of this is that some people who sign up for Guard duty, you know, for the benefits, you know, are going to think twice about it because of what's going on now throughout the country. And that's certainly a concern of people that are involved in recruiting for the National Guard.
Do we know at this point? I mean, obviously, in the grand scheme of things, not a huge amount of time has passed, although it certainly feels like it, since the start of the second Trump term. But do we know if recruitment rates are going down? And also, do we know if people are resisting in the ways that aren't so public?
Guard duty is not like being in the active duty military. I mean, people can put in for hardship waivers. They have other jobs. They people are going to school. There's lots of call-ups that people miss because they're able to get excused. And of course, that depends on who their state governor is and their state guard commander. So there are ways of people to get out of such duty. I mean, the best example of that, which we've written about, is the pushback that Texas Governor Greg Abbott experienced 4 years ago when, as part of a pre-election stunt in the state of Texas, he ordered up thousands of Guard members, Texas Guard members, for state duty, sent them to the U.S.-Mexican border. He was trying to embarrass the Biden administration. He allocated $2 billion for this effort. And this particular tour of duty was very unpopular among a lot of Texas Guard members whose lives were, and jobs, day jobs, were disrupted as a result of it. And it led to a very interesting organizing effort backed by my own union, the Communication Workers of America, and its Texas affiliate, the Texas State Employees Union. Really, for the first time in since the late 1960s, 1970s, there was an effort to sign up as union members, members of the military. In this case, National Guard members sent to the border who did not want to be there, objected to their working conditions and to the their use as political props by Governor Abbott in what he called Operation Lone Star, which was very much a one-state blueprint for what Trump is trying to do with control of the federal government in a number of states. And so I think, that organizing effort, which led to lobbying in the state legislature, about 50 Guard members signing up and becoming members of the Texas State Employees Union, is really a model for what we should be encouraging both the labor movement and veterans organizations in other states at the moment.
Well, let me ask you more about that. So the question of organizing the military is a complicated one, and I wanted to ask you more about how members of the U.S. military, and I realize it's easy to sort of blur categories, right? There's the active duty military, there's the National Guard, which is not the same commitment, and then, of course, there are veterans who may have served in the military recently or in the past. But I wonder if you could talk about the ways that members of the military have organized themselves in the past, starting with the Vietnam War, which, of course, unlike now, was based on conscription.
Well, as a lot of listeners know, particularly those who were active in the anti-Vietnam War movement of the late 60s and early 70s, one of the most dynamic and impactful components of it was the GI movement, the so-called Soldiers' Revolt against conscription, against being sent to the war in Vietnam. And one outgrowth of a lot of organizing among active duty GIs during that period was several union organizing efforts. One was backed by the members of the Black Panther Party, who had supporters who ended up drafted into the U.S. military. At that time, they started a group called the Movement for a Democratic Military. They demanded the right to collective bargaining for soldiers and, higher wages that met the federal minimum wage. There was also a left-led group called the American Servicemen's Union, the ASU. It issued membership cards. It organized local chapters on military bases, on naval vessels. It published a national newspaper, and it took inspiration from the soldiers' unions and associations in NATO countries, which even 60 or 70 years ago had already been formed and still function today. Ironically, at the time, though individual organizers of these efforts were court-martialed and harassed and otherwise disciplined, that activity was not illegal at the time. It was not until 1977, after this experience of this GI revolt, that Democrats and Republicans in Congress, including Joe Biden, then a member of the Senate, working with Republican Strom Thurmond from South Carolina, introduced bipartisan legislation which banned membership in any, quote, military labor organization, made that a felony, subject to penalties up to 5 years in jail. So after that, you essentially had a ban on unionization of uniformed employees of the U.S. Department of Defense. Civilian employees can be members of the American Federation of Government Employees. But that ban, as a result of a ruling by the Justice Department under Joe Biden a year or two ago, doesn't apply to National Guard members under state control. So there is an opening, I believe, still for encouraging Guard members to form associations, to engage in collective activity, to speak out publicly, both about the terms and conditions of their employment and about, you know, the political objectives that they may oppose, that the deployments to assist in a roundup of millions of other people in this country who are here but undocumented.
Labor journalist and lawyer Steve Early is my guest. He's co-author with Suzanne Gordon of Our Veterans, Winners, Losers, Friends, and Enemies on the New Terrain of Veterans Affairs. I'm Sasha Lilly. This is Against the Grain. So, Steve, as you were narrating that history from the Vietnam War to the present, Minnesota plays an interesting role in some of that history. You know, the site of the Hormel meat packers strike, which the National Guard was brought into, and then again during the George Floyd protests. Tell us about that history and how the labor movement related to the military in that moment.
Yeah, certainly over the last 150 years, state militias, which became National Guard units, have been called out various times during periods of labor unrest, strike situations, and as you note, several times in recent decades by Democrats who were governors of the state of Minnesota. One instance was a very bitter and protracted anti-concession strike by dissident members of the United Food and Commercial Workers at the Hormel meatpacking plant in Austin, Minnesota in the late 1980s. The Guard was called out there in a way that was not helpful to the strike. And, you know, again, another example of the kind of contradictions and tensions that Guard members may experience today. I mean, if you're a part-time soldier, citizen soldier, weekend warrior, you got a regular job. You may have two. And sometimes Guard members, Guard members are union members in their own jobs. Well, who wants to be called up to play cop in somebody else's strike? So Guard duty of that sort historically has not always been universally popular with everyone, sent to police a picket line. You know, more recently, ironically, the governor involved in Minnesota calling up the Guard, Tim Walz, 2020, was a longtime Guard member himself. The Guard was called out both during the original protests over George Floyd's killing, but also a year or two later when the police officer, Derek Chauvin, a veteran, was convicted of killing Floyd. There was concern that if the jury acquitted him, there would be a second round of unrest in Minneapolis. And the second time, interestingly enough, union members, including some folks in the Communication Workers of America, learned that the Guard was being deployed out of the St. Paul Labor Center. And a crowd of labor activists from a number of different unions, the Minnesota Nurses Association, the Carpenters, CWA, went to the labor center and protested their union hall being used as a staging ground, and put enough pressure on the officer in charge of that detachment to force that particular group of Guards members to pack up and go away. And there was a lot of fraternization that went on along at that moment because people realized that people were following orders. Some of them were fellow union members. They didn't necessarily want to be there. Some of them were people of color, sympathetic to the protests and demands for police reform in the wake of Floyd's killing. So, again, I think we're going to be seeing more and more of those situations, and particularly Guard members from immigrant families, from union families, are not going to be happy with things that they've already been asked to do in some places and maybe asked to do on a wider scale in the future, near future.
Steve Early, the left has often, I think, gotten a bit confounded about how to think about organizing people in the military. And as I mentioned earlier, of course, when we're speaking of the military, we're talking about different groupings of people, the active duty military being different than the National Guard and then those people who are veterans. And I think part of this is that veterans in recent decades have tended to support the Republican Party. In 2024, 65% of military veterans voted for Trump. Why do you think that is? And do you think that that is something that could shift? I don't mean voting patterns per se, but an orientation towards the right versus the left.
Well, I think groups like the Progressive Veterans Organization Common Defense have really been struggling with this challenge of how to reach vet voters, certainly over the last three presidential election cycles, where Common Defense was one of the most active groups, along with Vote Vets and several others, trying to rally former service members against Trump. They did better the year that Biden beat Trump in the popular vote and became president for 4 years. Neither Hillary Clinton or Kamala Harris did as well against Trump among veteran voters. I think there's a lot going on right now that, is the basis for vet voter remorse about supporting Trump. I mean, you got 1.2 million veterans, who are so low income, they qualify for food stamps, a program that is being adversely impacted by, the shutdown. You have an attack on federal workers, the federal workforce, hundreds of thousands of federal employees in different agencies, the VA and the Department of Defense being two of the largest, are former military personnel. And, even an issue like the whole shutdown struggle between the Democrats and Republicans and the Trump administration and Congress about the fate of the Affordable Care Access subsidies, which make private health insurance more affordable for millions of people, that affects many veterans and their families as well, who are not eligible for VA coverage that applies to about 9 million service members. So there's a lot of issues out there that I think, if we can organize around them and rally people, even those who might have veterans who might have voted for Trump once, twice, or three times might be a lot more reluctant to support him or someone like him in the future or people aligned with him in House and Senate races next year.
One thing that has gotten attention, at least certainly on social media, is a number of cases of ICE abducting people who are veterans. Is that something that people are organizing around, veterans themselves are organizing around?
Very much so. I mean, there's been several high-profile cases of veterans themselves being detained by ICE. One of the recruitment pitches for children of undocumented workers is, if you sign up, become a member of the active duty military, it can help your parents legalize their immigration status. So there have been some instances in which soldiers discovered that their mother or father ended up in ICE detention before they could complete that process. It's inevitable when you have a military today that's 40% people of color, increasingly female, increasingly diverse. The poor and working class people who are looking to the military as a source of steady employment and good health care coverage, an opportunity for learning some skills and eventually getting assistance with higher education costs through the GI Bill. A lot of the military recruitment these days is targeting immigrant communities. So I think it creates internal contradictions and tensions, particularly when you have a Trump appointee running the Department of Defense who's openly hostile to diversity in the military, has demoted or forced into retirement some of the highest ranking African-American and female military officers, who's driven out of military service more than 4,000 trans people, and basically every day on the job displays increasing contempt for the problems and concerns of rank-and-file enlisted people.
That's the voice of labor journalist Steve Early. He's co-author with my other guest, Suzanne Gordon, of Our Veterans, Winners, Losers, Friends, and Enemies on the New Terrain of Veterans Affairs. I'm Sasha Lilly, and this is Against the Grain on Pacifica Radio. So turning to you, Suzanne, before I ask you about the state of the Department of Veterans Affairs, that is the VA medical system, which is under attack by the Trump administration, I wonder if you could remind our listeners what the VA is and why it stands out within the American healthcare system.
The VA is the Department of Veterans Affairs, and it has three sub-agencies. The Veterans Health Administration, which runs the largest and only publicly funded comprehensive healthcare program in the country. The Veterans Benefits Administration, that is very connected to the to this discussion, which runs the largest benefit system in the country, and the National Cemeteries Administration. And the real attack here today that we're concerned about it is the attack on the VHA, the health system, and the VBA, the benefit system. In connection to the conversation about organizing, it's very important, I think, for those folks who are listening in, to who are healthcare reform advocates and social justice advocates, to understand that the Veterans Health Administration and Benefits Administration is a socialized healthcare system, and they run a sort of socialized benefit system for a small slice of the American population, military veterans. And the VA serves not just the Veterans Health Administration, serves not only veterans, but the entire nation. I mean, the VA trains 70% of American physicians, most American psychologists and nurses. They're the hub of the health professional training program in the country. They're the second biggest research powerhouse after the National Institutes of Health. Think the shingles vaccine, the first implantable cardiac pacemaker, the nicotine patch, and they're critical in the response, which is very connected to this issue of the Guard, to emergencies, healthcare emergencies or national emergencies like wildfires or hurricanes or whatever. So, and very few people understand that. They also don't understand that not all veterans have access to the Veterans Health Administration or veterans benefits. As we explain in Our Veterans, you have to have the right military discharge, you have to have a proven service-connected disability and or low income, or served in a post 9/11 combat zone. And so, you know, the issue of organizing veterans involves educating yourself about the role of the second largest healthcare, the second largest federal department, which is the VA, the Department of Veterans Affairs. And I find that very few people, you know, they know there are VA hospitals and clinics, they see the signs, but they have very little understanding of what they do, and they also have very little understanding that they serve more than veterans. And so, you know, you and I have a stake in the future of the VA, even if we're not a veteran, because if you needed a pacemaker, you know, these developments and innovations and research studies that they conduct, and you know, they're not just for veterans only. And so most people, I find, just that, you know, it's kind of the invisible department. I mean, they know it's there, but they don't really know what it does, and they don't think it serves more than veterans, and it does. And they also don't understand how they can organize veterans to fight for broader social programs that are very progressive that they themselves enjoy. And it's a very sad thing that I think on the left people assume that veterans are all just unified in their conservative beliefs, and that's not true. I mean, we have Common Defense, Veterans for Peace, and, you know, the veteran vote shifts. I mean, there is a very strong conservative bent in it, but it can also move if these programs are attacked or if their families and communities are attacked. And it is moving now. We're seeing that.
And I want to come back to that, Suzanne, but I wanted to just ask you a bit more when you were talking about the VA and saying that most of us on the left don't really understand it, don't understand how it works. I wonder if you could just say a few more words about why it is unique as a public health system, because, of course, there are people who organize for Medicare for all, but what the VA healthcare system is, in fact, is different than that. It's really a socialized healthcare system of a kind that, you know, we find in other countries, but not in the United States.
The healthcare system run by the Department of Veterans Affairs is absolutely unique. And I really favor VA for all rather than Medicare for all, because Medicare is a payer. It's not a payer and a provider. And the VA healthcare system is both a payer of healthcare and a provider of healthcare. And when you're both, it's like the national health system in Britain or the Scandinavian health system. So you can be much more innovative when you control not only the purse strings, but the practice. And so you have, you know, basically in the VA, you have a fully integrated system with the same electronic medical record. Everybody's on salary. And so you don't have people on fee-for-service. Medicare for all, for example, would support a fee-for-service system and paying fees for service. But, you know, that's a very problematic sort of system, because in a fee-for-service system, you have an incentive for the patient to stay sick, because you only get fees for, you know, for services. There's even a built-in incentive for fragmentation of care. There's even a built-in incentive for medical error, because when there's a medical error, people need more services unless they just right out die. And in the VA, everybody's on salary, so there's no incentive to over-treat or under-treat. And we see that in the statistics when veterans go, for example, to the private sector for prostate cancer, they're much more likely to be recommended surgery or invasive radiation, even for minimally serious prostate cancer. They're more likely to get to be recommended a knee replacement or a shoulder replacement or hip replacement when PT would do, because there's no incentive in the VA for that kind of over-treatment. I mean, we saw that during COVID, for example. While the VA instantly, as soon as it became clear what we were facing, the VA instantly shut down all elective surgery because there was no financial penalty for shutting down elective surgery, whereas the private sector hospital across the street continued for you know, several weeks or even a month, because there are financial ramifications when a orthopedist can't do a total knee. And so it has also many advantages, because research and teaching can all be interconnected with a stable set of patients who you have from discharge to grave. You can do prevention much more effectively in that kind of system because you have a stable group of patients. In a private insurance system, it doesn't really pay to emphasize prevention, because your patient population turns over so quickly that if you, you know, start a preventive measure when the patient is 40, you're likely to reap the benefit when the patient is 60, and that patient won't be in your system anymore. In the VA, that patient will be in your system. I would argue that the VA is literally, and I mean this literally, the VA is literally our only healthcare system in America. We have other arrangements. I hate to call what we have in America a system, but we have many other arrangements in the private sector that deliver episodic, fragmented medical treatment. And medical treatment is only a very small part of healthcare. The VA does medical treatment and it also does healthcare. It deals with people's economic situation, with mental health, with job training and retraining, with legal issues, with homelessness. It deals with what we call the social determinants of health. It's the only healthcare system in the country that does that. And it's also an occupational healthcare system, which considered, you know, what did you do in the military? What are the consequences of that? American medicine does not do occupational health almost at all. And so it's really an extraordinary system when it's well-funded and well-staffed. And it's very successful, and the studies show over and over again that it has superior outcomes. And that's why the right wing is attacking it. It's attacking it ideologically and financially. Many of the forces that rule this country do not want a government program that, you know, not only works well, but that beats the competition of the private sector. Because one of the rules in American capitalism is that the government isn't allowed to win or to best, you know, the private sector, because the ideology is that the government can do no right and the private sector no wrong. And in this case, we have a government-run healthcare system that is much better than anything the private sector delivers. And they are determined to privatize that ideologically and financially, because they can't bear the fact that, you know, hundreds of, you know, billions of dollars are going into a public system rather than into private bank accounts.
Right, and that campaign to try and privatize the VA, outsource its services to actually expensive private medical providers, for example, has been going on for quite a while. But a golden opportunity was presented this spring when Elon Musk and Doge took a wrecking ball to much of the administrative state. How has the VA been targeted and affected this year?
So basically, we have Elon Musk, and then we have another character called Doug Collins, who was a former congressman from Georgia and a Trump acolyte, who was nominated to be the Secretary of Veterans Affairs. He is a veteran, he was a chaplain in the Air Force. And so he has come in with his own wrecking ball. I mean, the Doge folks, at their instigation, one of the first things that they did in the VA was fire all probationary employees, they fired about 2,400 probationary employees. And one of the interesting things in the government is that in the VA, and I think in the federal government as a whole, a probationary employee isn't somebody that just is new to an agency, but also somebody who has maybe worked in the agency for 20 years, but switches jobs, and then they somehow are on probation again, which is something that needs to be rectified if we ever get a better administration in Congress. They also canceled research contracts for researchers who are on what are called contracts that renewable contracts every 3 years. And Collins and Doge canceled a whole bunch of those researchers. And this interrupted many research studies that would have an impact not only on veterans' health, but on the health of the entire nation and world, really. Collins announced that he was going to cut 83,000 staff, bringing the staffing levels of the Veterans Health Administration, which has about 400,000 employees, 100,000 of whom or more are veterans. He announced that he was going to bring that down to 2019 levels. And in 2019, the VA was very understaffed. People fought back, and now he's announced that he would only cut 30,000 through attrition, essentially not filling jobs that were left if somebody got a new job and left the VA or retired or died. And of course, every healthcare system or business has attrition, right? People leave, people die, people retire, and a healthy system or business replaces those people. In this case, Collins has said he won't replace them, and he actually may take their jobs off the org chart, which is very bad. He's promised that none of these cuts will impact direct care, but that's not true. People are leaving the VA because it's such a hostile workplace. There was just an article that was republished in the American Prospect, where I published a lot, about the impact of the cuts he said he wasn't making on staff. These cuts are also, or all the chaos that's being created is also impacting morale. For example, one of the other things he did was just cut down, just eliminate all union contracts and union bargaining rights, and eject unions from, many of the unions have premises on the VA. He ejected them all from their offices. So people have no rights anymore as workers. And, while this is often portrayed as a sort of labor workers' rights issue, when you're running a healthcare system, creating a hostile workplace and abrogating union rights and denying people a voice is really a patient safety issue, because this is a system that runs hospitals and clinics, and it's they're not producing like envelopes or thumbtacks, and it's really important for a nurse in a hospital or a clinic to feel that she can say to a doctor, "You're giving the wrong drug," or "You're about to, cut off the wrong leg," without feeling that she could be disciplined or fired. And so this has a lot of patient safety implications. And now, for example, they're attacking VA benefits, and veterans are compensated for certain conditions that they acquire or have exacerbated in the military, or illnesses or injuries. So you don't just receive money when you receive a VA disability rating, you receive access to health care. And they're very upset, the Republicans, about the PACT Act, the act that was passed under the Biden administration that would give veterans from many different eras who had toxic exposures VA care and compensation. The Republicans were forced to support that when they voted against it. And now the House voted to cut PACT Act funding. The Senate didn't follow suit. And so they're attacking the PACT Act by attacking care and compensation for folks who got these exposures. In one really egregious act that they just took, they have denied that male breast cancer, which was considered a presumed result of certain toxic exposures, they have denied that what we call presumptive condition, which could impact the care of a tiny amount of men, because a tiny amount of men get breast cancer. Probably about 100 veterans a year. And these aren't trans veterans. These are just guys, because, guys have breasts, and a few of them can get breast cancer. It's very lethal. And they basically claim that saying that male breast cancer is a presumed result of toxic exposures violates the president's order on gender diversity and biological truth. There's a big protest against this, and this is another way that you can organize veterans, because when you start taking money out of people's pockets, because rightly they are compensated for the injuries and illnesses they acquired in military service, the VA and some of the right-wing Republicans are a little bit worried about the backlash that this is going to create.
Well, let's talk about that. So you said earlier that the political orientation of veterans, this tendency to lean toward the right, that that's not monolithic, that's not every veteran, and that it's not fixed, that those attitudes change over time. And I wonder how you think that in this moment where veteran services are being attacked, the social supports that many veterans get being cut away, and all of these things that seem very transparent, in a moment like this, how best can the left help foster organization of veterans and help them organize themselves, especially since those who oppose war often can feel uneasy about supporting veterans, somehow feeling like the war machine then extends to their services?
Well, that idea has got to be revamped and reversed. I mean, these people signed up for the military, not because, I mean, I'm sure there are some of them who are very militaristic, but there are most people who sign up for the military in this country sign up, it's an economic draft, you know, they come from poor working class families, and they sign up because they're promised, you know, health care and education. I mean, that's the pitch, right? And I mean, if you look at the ads for the military, right, like if you look at Go Army or something like that, you know, they're essentially promising you a kind of finishing school for poor people. You know, you can get a better job. You can be a scientist, you know, you can, you know, be a nurse, you can be this, you can be that. So people are joining up because they are not, you know, upper middle class folks. They don't have any opportunities. They don't have opportunities for travel. They don't have social networks that can get them a job in a law firm or get them into, you know, a good college. And they buy that pitch. And many of them, by the way, who voted for Trump, I mean, I co-founded something called the Veterans Healthcare Policy Institute, and we did a very interesting Facebook campaign that targeted veterans in 8 swing states. And we tried to warn them about Project 2025 and what it would do to their healthcare and benefits. And it was very interesting that a lot of MAGA folks or veterans who were going to vote for Trump responded to this ad campaign. And none of them said, oh, we think this is wonderful. We think they should privatize the VA and cut back on veterans' benefits. They all said to a person, he will never do that. Trump said he doesn't know what Project 2025 is. He would never do that. And of course, he is doing that. So this is a great organizing opportunity to go to veterans and not to say, we told you so, because that's a very bad organizing strategy, but to say, you didn't want to have this happen, and it's happening. And they know it's happening. I mean, we're seeing veterans come out to rallies in front of VA hospitals who've never been to a rally before, who voted for Trump. And it was like, wait a minute, this wasn't what I voted for. And so, I mean, I think the trick in organizing veterans is figuring out how to find them. I mean, Common Defense is a great group. Save Our VA campaign in Veterans for Peace is a great group to support. But, you know, if you're a healthcare reformer, the VA, yeah, I mean, they never talk about the VA. You know, you have to start talking about the VA when you talk about cuts, right? You have to include that in your pitch. And you may not actually go to the VFW or the American Legion or whatever, but people read the papers, people read social media. And if the left is silent, which fortunately some groups aren't, but if people are silent on you know, the VA, because why should we support the VA? It's part of the military establishment. It isn't part of the military establishment. It's picking up the pieces that the military establishment creates. I mean, I know people, Sasha, who actually think, lefties who know a lot about healthcare, who have said that the VA's budget comes from the Department of Defense. I mean, hello? And so I think people really need to educate themselves about the VA and fight for the VA, whether you ever speak to a veteran or not, or go to a rally in front of a VA. They're happening all over the country. Go talk to some vets, you know. Go on social media. I mean, there's lots of ways to reach people. And I think the more that people stand up for the benefits and healthcare that veterans receive, people can see they're on their side. Because right now, the right is constructing the left as anti-working class, you know, elitist, anti-veteran. And we have this huge opportunity now that Trump is offering us to really contradict this erroneous impression that the right is trying to create. And I think we need to take advantage of that opportunity.
Suzanne, let me end by asking you about Veterans Day itself. You've been working with the grassroots progressive veterans group Common Defense. How are people organizing around Veterans Day? And more broadly, beyond the VA, are people organizing around these deployments or threats of deployments of the military into other U.S. cities?
Yeah, I mean, Common Defense is very active in this. Veterans for Peace is very active in this. They're doing all kinds of rallies, and Common Defense is you know, really has this great VA for Self campaign. And I think that, you know, we have to think beyond Veterans Day, and we have to, you know, I think one of the things that it's going to be really important for folks on the left to do is to push these candidates who are running against Republicans to include the VA, you know, to talk about how the VA can help with the rural healthcare crisis. That's a really great way to recruit rural Americans. What's about to happen to an already stressed rural healthcare systems? I think we just have to integrate veterans' concerns into our discussions, our broader discussions. It's the same organizing challenge you face when you try to convince anybody of necessary social change, but it's one that I think Trump, ironically, has made easier.
Suzanne Gordon, Steve Early, thank you.
Thank you, Sasha, for having us on.
Thank you.
I've been speaking with Suzanne Gordon and Steve Early. They are the authors of Our Veterans, Winners, Losers, Friends, and Enemies on the New Terrain of Veterans Affairs. Suzanne Gordon is a journalist and editor, co-founder of the Bay Area-based Veterans Healthcare Policy Institute. Steve Early is a longtime labor journalist and lawyer, author of many books, including The Civil Wars in U.S. Labor. You've been listening to Against the Grain. I'm Sasha Lilly. Thanks so much for listening, and please tune in again next time.